Okay, it's time to commit. 2024 is the year for prioritizing yourself. Begin your new smile journey with Byte, and you could start seeing results in just 2 to 3 weeks. Just order your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95 at Byte.com. Byte clear liners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces, plus they offer financing options, accept eligible insurance, and you could pay with your HSA, FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
Hello, everybody, and welcome. Welcome to this latest edition of the Bill Press Pod and our weekly roundtable. Looking at the news of the week, it is 8:30 a.m., more or less, on Friday, July 12, here in the nation's capital. And it's the tail end of another busy week. You know, there's no such thing as a non-busy week, it seems, in the Trump world. And this week, again, a week with many ups and downs and even a few sideways. On top of it all, doing their jobs to keep track of it and tell us what's going on, three of Washington's best political reporters and commentators join us today to try to make sense of it all. Eliza Collins covers national politics for the Wall Street Journal. Hello, Eliza.
Hi there.
Good to see you. Jason Dick is the deputy editor of Roll Call, a great newspaper covering the Hill and the White House. Hello, Jason.
Hello, Bill.
Thanks for taking time today, as well as Richard Fowler, who hosts his own nationally syndicated show, The Richard Fowler Show. Hello, Richard.
Good morning, Bill.
Welcome to you all. The latest little tiff here in Washington occurring overnight. A new book came out by Tim Alberta from Politico called American Carnage, of course, a phrase made famous in Donald Trump's inaugural address, where Tim Ryan, former speaker, blessed
Paul Ryan.
Tim Ryan is a presidential candidate.
800 presidential candidates.
I get all those.
I thought we were at 1,000 presidential candidates.
I get those Ryan brothers mixed up. Okay, Paul Ryan, former speaker. Thank you. Blessed President Trump, saying he didn't know any. Basically, he didn't know what he was doing. Didn't know anything about governing. And Paul Ryan said he could stand being around him another 2 years, and that's why he quit. Then Donald Trump came out, called him basically a poor loser, a lame duck loser. What, Eliza, what's going on here?
Well, I think we could have guessed that would go just like how it did. But, you know, as someone who covered The Hill and covered Paul Ryan, I think we all kind of had a sense that he was very frustrated by the president. But he really did a good job of not saying that and seeming like they were on the same team and insisting that he was retiring because he wanted to be with his teenage children and see them grow up. And he really just went there in this book. And so while it is not entirely surprising that he thinks these things, it is very surprising, I think, that Paul Ryan said them. It is not surprising that Trump reacted the way he did.
Yeah, so Jason, he had a chance.
Oh, yes, he did. He did.
Just to speak up, right?
He did, but, I mean, in more ways than one, this is the infamous Casablanca scene. I'm shocked that gambling is going on here. Here, you're winning, sir. I mean, Paul Ryan, you know, was complicit in what happened during his time as speaker. And, you know, I think, as Eliza said, everybody had a pretty good inclination that this is how he probably felt about the president. I mean, he said some not dissimilar things, although not as arched in the campaign, in the 2016 campaign. And then he just sort of quietly, you know, went into it. It seemed like he was gone before he was actually gone his last 2 years, especially that last year where he was kind of done fighting with the Freedom Caucus and done, you know, fighting with the president. And so it's not shocked, but it's also, he was there all along. He knew exactly what was going on. And I think we all knew he knew what was going on. But now he says it, you know, in Tim's book.
But I think it's one of the larger problems with the entire Republican, I would say the establishment part of the Republican Party, right, is that what you hear them say is after they leave Washington, after they sort of set their sails and get to Dulles Airport or get to Reagan Airport and get on the plane, they have so many bad things to say about Donald Trump. But while they're here, none of these things are ever said, none of these things are ever spoken, which is what has led to Donald Trump becoming such a powerful president and such becoming the leader of the Republican Party in such a major way, is because even governors, none of them will speak out against him. They will say nothing about him. But as soon as they leave office, like, oh, he was horrible. This is the worst guy ever. He's hard. He doesn't know how to govern. He doesn't know how to lead. But they won't say that when they're in front of him. They won't say that when they work for his White House. They won't. They'll never say this. I mean, or they'll say it before, and when they're working for him, they won't say it. The greatest example I could think about right now is Ken Cuccinelli, right? This former Attorney General of Virginia. Horrible things to say about Donald Trump before he got elected. Horrible things to say once he got elected. Now he works for him. Now he thinks he's the greatest guy on earth. And I'm pretty sure when Donald Trump fires him for a misstep he makes on television, then he'll be like, oh, he's horrible again. So this is part of the problem that the Republican Party has when it comes to how they deal with Donald Trump. And I do think that this is going to have irreparable harm on their brand moving forward after he leaves office.
Yeah. Eliza. The president is incredibly popular with the Republican base. He is still, you know, he's controversial with the public at large, but he is very popular with the base. And Republicans, you know, they need to be reelected. And I think we see that a lot with just Republicans that go into cycle, how they have a hard time. If they distance themselves from President Trump, they have to end up dropping out. I mean, we saw that with Jeff Flake. We saw Bob Corker. Mm-hmm. Those were senators who spoke out against the president. And it, especially with Jeff Flake, he said it appeared he would not win a primary. Justin Amash is the most recent example. He's a member of the House, spoke out against the president, said it's time to impeach the president, and he just left the Republican Party, wasn't kicked off his committees. He resigned from committees, from the Republican conference. It's not clear, you know, he could have won a primary in his state.
And we saw a fancy two-step this week on the census.
This is my favorite story of the week. In a week filled with favorite stories,
which everybody was scratching their head about, because first of all, there's so many players here. But standing alongside of the president when he made his announcement that he was going to take this alternative approach to making sure and asking everybody if they're a citizen or not, standing alongside him was the Attorney General of the United States, Bill Barr, who said all this talk that we were going to add this to the census was undo it by executive order was just nonsense. Here's the Attorney General.
Some in the media have been suggesting in the hysterical mode of the day that the administration has been planning to add the citizenship question to the census by executive fiat without regard to contrary court orders or what the Supreme Court might say. This has been based on rank speculation and nothing more.
Now, who of all people might have suggested that we would do this by executive order?
Are you going to issue an executive order on the census?
We're thinking about doing that. It's one of the ways. We have four or five ways we can do it. It's one of the ways that we're thinking about doing it very seriously. So we're working on a lot of things, including an executive order.
Jason,
not to go overboard with pop culture references, but Bill Barr, I think, is best understood not as a law enforcement official, but as a intelligence official, and that was his. Like, you remember, he worked for the CIA before he went into justice work and so forth, and was George H.W. Bush's attorney general. He played this brilliantly, like psychologically, just sort of, you know. I mean, it's a subtle form of gaslighting. And I thought of Alec Guinness's Smiley in a Le Carre novel, just, you know, in the television series, just sort of calmly explaining why you're insane and why you should think differently than you think, and you just can't understand why you're such an idiot. You know, I mean, just very calmly, flatly, you know, gaslighting the country.
And Richard, the truth is, they lost this battle in the Supreme Court, right?
Yeah.
Yes. Which they just can't admit.
Yes. I mean, I think they not only did they lose this battle at the Supreme Court, and they lost this battle not necessarily because it was wrong. And don't get me wrong, I think it's problematic to ask a citizenship question, but it's been on the census before. They lost this because of how they went about putting it on and the rationale for putting it on, right? Which is, I think, is where the problem in it lies, is that they wanted to put this on because they had an intention of using it for other purposes. And I think the fact that they went and they did this at the Rose Garden, They did this the same
in between torrential rainstorms.
Yeah, in between torrential rainstorms.
After the same, social media summit.
I was going to say the same day they had the social media summit where they had individuals that are, at best, I would say, are, you know,
James O'Keefe and so forth.
You know, the very, very suspect characters.
All right. Let me interrupt. Show of hands here. How many of you were invited to the social media summit?
Well, not just none of us were. The social media companies, Facebook, Twitter, they were also not.
Continue, Richard.
And so it just speaks to this sort of, but it, here's the thing, in the eyes of his base, which were, I think where we started this conversation, the base loved this. And so the question, I think, the question for Donald Trump, I think the question from the larger national question, I think the question as you sort of look at this in the 2020 picture is, how do Democrats combat this president who's doing all of these moves are intentionally built for his base to keep his base together? Now, I think the two questions is, how big is this base? Will this base turn out for him again in 2020? And what are the implications of this? What impact does these type of events have on his base? And I think those are the larger questions that we have to ask ourselves as we get closer and closer to the 2020 election.
And it moves, Eliza, to this weekend, at least unless the president again pulls the plug on a round of raids by ICE pre-announced to start this Sunday on families where there could be someone living there who is undocumented, and rounding them up and deporting them.
Exactly. And as you said, this was he pulled the plug on this before, so there's a chance he could do that again. The president has no issue saying something's going to happen and then deciding it is not. But this is a play to his base. We see the president do things related to immigration, sort of extreme measures related to immigration, as a campaign tactic. And his base wants this to happen. So he has announced that they will have immigration raids this weekend. And this is something that is playing directly to a section of the electorate. And we, like you said, we don't know how big it is. But to them, it is very important. Now, the real question is, does this turn off a different section of the electorate, sort of that middle section, those establishment Republicans, those independents who, you know, don't really want their neighbors' ICE raids in their neighborhood, even if they might have some questions about undocumented immigrants. And we just don't know the answer. And I think, you know, but it's not great optics for them if there are raids all across the country this weekend.
And even though this, you know, the census, what happened with it, is a defeat for the president and his team and so forth. It's important, I think, to note that, one, they could have done this all along. I mean, this was one of two options that was presented to Wilbur Ross, the Commerce Secretary, to have other agencies give him information. The chief census, like, data scientist said, like, you can ask a citizenship question, or you can just have, like, you know, all the other departments, you know, give you this information. They knew that a year and a half ago. So they spent a year and a half just in court and dealing with this. But the effect, and again, something that you can't measure, right? I mean, this is like perfect for somebody who's looking to intimidate people. How many particularly Latinos are not going to answer the census just because now they're freaked out? Because, like, for the last several months, they've seen, you know, people put into cages the president rail about this on and on and on and on. So the effect of it may be similar to what he wanted, which was to, you know, use this for redistricting and depress census participation from particularly from Hispanics.
Well, and I want to say the way they handled this in the Rose Garden yesterday, as if this was a victory, they just sort of plowed right over it. This is, people aren't keeping up with what's been happening with the census the way we at this table are. The public might not be clear. They might not know if it's on there or not. So, like you said, and if you're an undocumented immigrant, it might be easier just not to answer the census at all because you're a little bit confused about what's happening.
It's hard to keep up with how the census is going and how, if at all, they're going to get this information or be able to ask that question. It's also hard to keep up with who the current labor secretary is. as of this moment, so far as we know,
you're giving yourself 2-3 hours lead time. I see. Oh, that's brave.
Secretary Acosta is still in the job. He tried hard to keep his job with this news conference this week. Richard, did he make the deal?
We'll have to wait and see. One thing that this president does not like is he does not like bad press. And I think this looked really bad. That sort of Hail Mary press conference that Acosta pulled, tried to pull off was problematic for a lot of reasons. One, he sort of blamed the victims. Two, he talked about how great his office was. He referred to this prosecutor by just calling her she, and she did everything right. It seemed very problematic. It seemed like he was trying to cover this sort of this thing up. And what we see from, and we're talking about the Julian Epstein case and his involvement in it, and what we see from the Southern District of New York, based on what we see from their evidence, that they have a pretty much an open and shut case. The good news for Acosta here is that there's a lot of other elites involved on both sides of the aisle, both Democrats and Republicans, who shielded Epstein from going to jail. And I think so for in Acosta's wagering of this, he says, listen, if I could hang out a little bit longer, there's more folks who will also come down in this. And so I think that's what he's wagering. Like, if I can just do this press conference, knowing that if I stay around for another week, another day, maybe another 2 days, more bigwigs will fall, i.e. former presidents, current presidents, former Fed president. There's a lot of folks
even
involved.
Kevin Spacey's involved.
Yeah, there's a lot of people involved in this.
Of course.
That's his only saving grace.
Before, Jason, Eliza, before you add your two cents, I just want to know, there are some still who ask, Acosta who? I hardly knew the guy.
Well, I knew him like everybody in Palm Beach knew him. I mean, people in Palm Beach knew him. He was a fixture in Palm Beach. I had a falling out with him a long time ago.
That was Epstein, of course.
I've spoken to him for 15 years. I was not a fan of his, that I can tell you. I was not a fan of his. So I feel very badly, actually, for Secretary Acosta.
How he ties the two together there. But this is a classic. Paul Manafort, he hardly ever knew
right.
Paul Manafort
his
either,
campaign
right?
Campaign chairman, yeah. No, yeah. I mean, this is a very classic Trump move. When he's not quite sure what's going to happen and how things will shake out, he just says he distances himself. I mean, we saw this in a more serious note a few weeks back when a woman accused the president of raping her, and he said he had never met her. And in the article where she did it, there was a photo of them together. So this is a very classic tactic of the president.
Of course, she wasn't his type. Either, right? And there are photos of Trump with Epstein. In fact, Epstein says that he's the one who introduced Trump to Melania. Right. Who knows?
It is this classic Trump move. I mean, it gives him some distance, and he knows that while people like who observe him are not fooled by this, most people are not going to, they're not going to click on the article. They're just going to look on the headline, and that says Trump says he doesn't know Epstein, and that's gonna be good enough for him. And getting back to Acosta, I mean, I'm reminded also of the third person at the podium in the Rose Garden yesterday, which is Wilbur Ross, who was like sort of trotted out as this potted plant, and then Bill Barr, you know, sits there and says, because the Commerce Department screwed this up, Wilbur, thanks. You know, I mean, and he, you know, and he didn't say any, Ross didn't say anything after the president and Barr said anything, and then they trotted him off, and it was just like, all right, we're going to go castrate Wilbur now. Bye, everybody. You know, I mean, it's just this weird situation where maybe he likes having these punching bags in his cabinet because they're very convenient foils. It reminds me of what Debbie Wasserman Schultz went through as DNC chair. You know, they seem to just kind of keep her around for, you know, just so she could attract all the arrows and then finally got rid of her when they needed to.
The surprising thing was, if I may, that Wilbur Ross stayed awake for the entire news conference.
Well, he was standing up, yes.
The only distinction with the Trump punching bags is a lot of these punching bags have a lot of power. I mean, the example I point to all the time is Betsy DeVos, right? So Betsy DeVos has been a punching bag for the entire administration, but truth be told, one of the most powerful cabinet secretaries mm-hmm. in this country is Betsy DeVos because of how much money she has pumped into the Republican machine. Right. She can call any governor, any state senator, any senator for that matter, and get whatever she wants because they all owe her something.
Or they owe Amway products, yes.
That too.
Well, Justin Amash, earlier when we talked about the Republican who mm-hmm. said president should be impeached, the DeVos family was funding his campaigns, and they pulled money, and that was partially, you know, why he was left. I think there wasn't money there anymore.
On that point, hold on, and let's take a quick break. It is the Bill Press Pod, and we're brought to you today by the American Federation of Teachers. Yes, that great group of men and women, America's teachers, making a difference in the classrooms every day. No group of Americans has demonstrated this political muscle more this year than America's teachers, mounting very popular and successful protests for better conditions for kids in schools in many states and for better consideration of teachers. Nobody's done it better than the proud members of the AFT under President Randy Weingarten. We salute them, thank them for the support of the podcast, and direct you to check out their website at aft.org.
The Angie's List you know and trust is now Angie, and we're so much more than just a list. We still connect you with top local pros and show you ratings and reviews, but now we also let you compare upfront prices on hundreds of projects and book a service instantly. We can even handle the rest of your project from start to finish. So remember, Angie's List is now Angie, and we're here to get your job done right. Get started at Angie.com. That's A-N-G-I, or download the app today.
Delve into the shadows of the mind with Sleeping Dogs, a gripping murder mystery starring Academy Award winner Russell Crowe. Now available on digital. Crowe portrays an ex-homicide detective unraveling a brutal murder he can't recall. Uncovering secrets from his past, he learns a chilling truth. It's best to let sleeping dogs lie. Visit sleepingdogsmovie.com/wondery to watch Sleeping Dogs, now on digital. That's sleepingdogsmovie.com/wondery.
CarMax is putting peace of mind back in car shopping by putting you in the driver's seat to find a ride that's right for you. Because at CarMax, we believe you shouldn't just settle for a car. You should love your car. That's why every car we sell is CarMax certified quality, so you can be sure with upfront pricing that's the same for every customer. So don't settle. Find love at first drive and start shopping now at CarMax.com. CarMax, the way car buying should be.
And we're back with this week's roundtable with Eliza Collins, Jason Dick, and Richard Fowler. Not all the tension has been on the Republican side of the aisle. Speaker Pelosi has had a little challenge this week from four newly elected women in the Congress who call themselves the Squad. What kind of a relationship does Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez have with the Speaker? Well, let's hear.
I think sometimes people think that we have this, like, we have a relationship.
Are you saying you don't?
Not particularly. Not one that's, I think, distinguished from anyone else.
Eliza, you spend more time walking the halls of the Congress than anybody else I know. What's going on?
Well, this reminds me a little bit of what happened with on the Republican side with the Freedom Caucus and Paul Ryan. Basically, Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez and the other three lawmakers, they're all freshmen. They all come from very progressive districts. But they are starting to realize their power with sort of the base of the Democratic Party. And Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, last time I checked, had, you know, 4.5 million Twitter followers. So they're speaking to this group, and they're a little bit confused about Nancy Pelosi and the Democratic establishment that says, you know, all of our conversations are behind closed doors, you get along with the party, you do what we tell you to do, and they're not doing that anymore. And she's going out in front of cameras and saying exactly that.
So Richard, they were sort of offended when the speaker pointed out, yeah, there are four people, they got four votes.
Listen, it's a very interesting conundrum.
Which is true,
by the way.
It's very true. It's a very interesting conundrum for the caucus. I think this, the entirety of it, from the macro level, that what makes this story very disheartening is, right, is you have this story happening on one side of Pennsylvania Avenue. And when we started this podcast, on the other side of Pennsylvania Avenue, you have the start of ICE raids this weekend, right? And I think what the Democratic Party suffers from is we don't have a very clear message on immigration. And what you have now is fracturing in the party, not only with these four individuals, but you also have fracturing with all the candidates. And so what we've got to put forward as we get closer to the Iowa caucus is a unified message on what is the Democratic Party's position on immigration? What is our position on the economy? What is our position on all of these issues so that we can convince these voters that are turned off by ICE raids in, on their block, or when somebody raids the people who manicure their lawns, or when somebody raids the people that take care of their children, right? What is our answer to that in this world of Donald Trump, which is what makes... which is why the Trump campaign is like, we're going to continue to double down on this because we have a Democratic Party that is indeed fractured.
But, Jason, are people making too much of this split among the Democratic caucus? I mean, Nancy Pelosi is still securely in charge.
Oh, yes. I mean, she's in charge. And I don't think that people are making too much of it, because I think this is very significant. And for all the speaker's dismissal of four freshmen, they do, you know, this is where a lot of the energy in the Democratic Party is coming from. I mean, there is a lot of, I mean, that doesn't mean that they have to set the agenda necessarily, but to talk to Maureen Dowd and sort of disparage them in the New York Times, in Dowd's column, to call them out on a repeated basis, it almost seems more than you need to do. I mean, Nancy Pelosi is in power for a reason, which is, you know, she knows how to wield it. And that's part of, I think, what Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez and her crew are figuring out, which is that they've probably never dealt with somebody like Nancy Pelosi. I mean, we're not talking about a generation-to-generation conflict. We're talking three generations separating them. I mean, like, the, you know, Nancy Pelosi is not even a boomer. I mean, she's a silent generation, you know, person. So this is somebody who, you know, knows how to wield her influence. And, you know, it's, if there's any sort of comfort to take from being swatted down by her, by Ocasio-Cortez and Rashida Tlaib and, you know, and Ayanna Pressley and so forth, is that, she's not just singling them out. I mean, another one of my favorite sort of, incidents that were, talked about this week was that in a meeting with some White House staff, and including Office of Management and Budget Acting Director Russell Vought, he made a point in a meeting, and she said, "And what is your name, dear?" I mean, she's just gonna be ruthless.
She did to Kellyanne Conway too. She called her to help.
She wouldn't talk to Kellyanne Conway.
I don't talk to staff. You know? Right. I mean, and she has dictated the terms of her negotiations now with the White House. So
right.
Well, and we've seen this with her interactions with the president as well. President Trump does not know what to make of her, and I think we can't say that about almost anybody else in Washington. Pelosi is used to getting her way. She is used to being ruthless. You know, she twists arms behind closed doors. I did a profile on her a few months back and talked to people, and someone said she does chocolate. In her office, there are chocolate and baseball bats, true, like San Francisco Giant baseball bats and Ghirardelli chocolate. And that's sort of how she leads. She can be sweet, but she also can use a bat. And when I asked her about it, she laughed, but she didn't say no. You know,
no, I mean, I think her daughter said it best. When she was just elected speaker, one of her daughters gave a very candid interview. And they're like, "My mother will cut you and you won't know you're bleeding for about 2 or 3 days later." And I think that's what makes speak. And listen, it's very interesting, right? Because I do believe that Pelosi and Ocasio-Cortez is cut from, they're cut from the same cloth. They're both powerful women who have the same moxie. And so this battle is very interesting, because I do think that Ocasio-Cortez has some staying power in the next, I wouldn't be shocked that in the next 10 to 15 to 20 years, we are calling her Speaker Ocasio-Cortez, just like we're calling her Speaker Pelosi. And so this battle is very indicative of where Ocasio-Cortez is going, or any of those four women for that matter. But I think where we are now, I think what Speaker Pelosi, her vision for where the caucus needs to go is, we've got to project where the party needs to go, because we are the only branch of government that's run by the Democratic Party right now. And I think this is the hardest battle that she has, even though she's maintaining, she has 90% of the caucus, well, really 99% of the caucus. But this is the tough part. This, I think, is her toughest battle.
So I want to circle back to President Trump, who said some, well, just about every day there's something you wonder, what? But said some very unusual things in the past week about the Continental Army having an Air Force, about the kidney and its relationship with the heart, about Fort McHenry. Here's a little compilation of Donald Trump at his best or worst.
"You've worked so hard on the kidney, very special. The kidney has a very special place in the heart.
Our army manned the airport. It ran the ramparts. It took over the airports. It did everything it had to do. And at Fort McHenry, under the rocket's red glare, it had nothing but victory.
Now, there is so much we could say about every one of those statements, but the one who has been talking about them more than anybody else seems to be George Conway, who has put out a series of tweets this week. Yes, husband of Kellyanne Conway, talking about really raising questions about the president's mental capacity and saying he keeps quoting this diagnostic and statistical manual of mental disorders and describing the narcissistic personality disorder and saying he's got it and here's the proof. We're going into uncharted territory here, Jason.
Well, certainly, when the Air Force takes off in 1776, yes, we are in uncharted territory.
They redid the cry of Paul Revere: one if by land, two if by sea, three if by air.
I mean, it is difficult to even keep up with. I haven't spent a lot of time in the president's presence. I get a little nervous when people start diagnosing from afar and quoting the DSM. I used to be married to a psychologist, so she was always very, sort of a by the book person. But it is hard not to think what is happening here. I mean, how is it? It's almost like it is beyond satire. You can't almost believe what some of the things that come out of his mouth. And I just think, the people who are with him are going to continue to be with him on those sort of things. They'll think like, oh, that's just Trump. He's just BSing, But if you're a more serious person and think that maybe a president should not have such slips of tongue, then
it's Eliza, last year,
a long year and a half.
Last year, there was a book, The Dangerous Case of Donald Trump, written by 27 leading psychiatrists in the country, who said, yeah, this guy's got a serious problem.
Right. This has been a conversation. It's not just new with George Conway. People have been saying this for a long time. But I think to Jason's point, supporters of the president are not suddenly going to look at a tweet from George Conway and say, yep, that's it. He's got that.
I was there until now.
Right. I mean, and I think when I talk to supporters of the president, they really say he likes to get a rise out of you. He does it to get a rise out of the media. Whether that's what the president is doing or it's a slip of the tongue, I don't know, and I can't even pretend to diagnose. But it is sort of just we're seeing a deeper and deeper divide. If you have questions about the president, you're going to continue to have questions, and it just gives more ammo for that. And if you like the president, you'll say, oh, that's just Trump being Trump. He's different than anyone else, and that's why we like him.
Is it a fair question to ask?
I think I tend to agree. I think the more you call him mentally ill, you call him mentally unstable, you sort of alienate yourself from people who voted for him the first time because you devalue yeah. their vote or whatever. It's the same as when people, attack Barack Obama. If you voted for Barack Obama, you were more staunch Obama supporter after people started attacking him. And I think if you look at the 2018, if you look at some of the exit polls from 2018, what you found is that people cared less about that stuff and they cared more about the fact that he was uncivil and he was mean. Mm. And I think that is a place where we're better off putting if you're trying to go after the president, like you attack him on the issues, right? And attack him on he says he promised one thing and he's doing something else. He promised that he was going to fix this and he hasn't fixed it. He promised that he was going to fix prescription drugs for seniors and we're still waiting, right?
I mean, you made the point about prescription drugs. The Democrats that won the midterms in 2018 did not win them by talking about the president at all. Right, they all say we did not talk about it exactly because what you just said is they didn't want to alienate voters who voted for the president and might still like him. What they won on was talking about health care and talking about immigration, family separations, the policies of the administration that people questioned and not the president's behavior, because people knew what they were getting when they voted for him in 2016. This is not like he suddenly changed in the last couple of months.
So of all of our efforts to keep up with everything that's happening on every front, there's always something that kind of grabs you during the week and becomes your favorite story. It can be serious or not so serious. Eliza, what caught your attention?
Well, you
favorite story.
You took it a little bit earlier when you talked about the Tim Alberta book at the very beginning of the podcast. But there's been excerpts all week about this, and I just cannot stop reading them. I mean, there's so many fascinating. People really gave these dishy interviews. But one that was sort of this little known undercover thing was that I found was that H.R. McMaster, who is now the governor of South Carolina, said that he had wanted to be.
Is he McMaster?
H.R. McMaster was McMaster
National
is
yeah. there National is Security Advisor, yeah.
Yes, McMaster is a governor of South Carolina, not H.R. McMaster.
Right. Yeah,
I don't know his first name. Sure. He said he wanted to be governor, an ally of the president's. He was lieutenant governor at the time. Nikki Haley, governor. And he said that he wanted to be that. President Trump said, okay. And suddenly Nikki Haley became UN ambassador. And I think that is really interesting because there's lots of talk about Nikki Haley and this bright future.
Yeah.
She's an Indian woman. She is a little bit more of a moderate voice. And Republicans were really excited to see her in that spot and to read in this book that it was really just a movement to get a Trump ally
in as governor.
Right. And of course, people had to vote for governor. It wasn't that the president just put him there, but it cleared the space. Hmm. And I thought that was an interesting
story that had not been told before.
Exactly. Although I saw some South Carolina reporters say this is something that's kind of been speculated for a long time. But here people were saying it on the record to Tim Alberta.
Yeah. How about you, Richard?
So an interesting one for me that came out was there was an interesting episode, a television episode, from the show, the FX show Pose. And so Pose is a new show that's sort of been a groundbreaking show where there are five transgendered women of color that are leads in the show. It's been groundbreaking since its founding, but it's a show that's sort of based in the late 80s and the early 90s that balances the inherent joy of being transgendered in the ball culture as well as dealing with the HIV/AIDS epidemic. But in this particular episode this week, it dealt with the violence of transgender people of color murders. And so in the episode, they literally talk about a transgender woman being murdered while engaging in sex work. It's a tear-jerking episode, but it while scripted, it almost like it was playing out in today's reality, where I think this year alone we've lost countless numbers of transgendered women to this particular crisis. And I think how it plays in today is while that's happening, right, juxtaposition that to where this administration is, in that the number one employer of transgendered people in the country is the United States military. So you have a president who said that he cares about the LGBTQ community, how he likes to pronounce it because he forgets the letters from time to time. And he says he cares about them, but he wants to ban them from the military, which is their number one employer in the country. Whereas and if they're not there and they have no place to work and they have no place to get health care and they have no place to not be discriminated against. And while that's happening, they're being murdered on our streets, including right here in the District of Columbia.
Jason.
It's the Kim Darich resignation and the fallout of the cables.
England's ambassador to the United States.
And it almost played out too perfectly, that Darich would, when the cables were, being unveiled and, he says, don't underestimate Trump. He has proven himself to be virtually indestructible, that people, just keep on saying that he'll self-immolate, but, like the Terminator, it'll just be this skeleton and it'll just keep coming for you. And that's what happened to Kim Darich. He thought that he was sending confidential cables, which is his job, to inform, Her Majesty's government about the not just the goings on in Washington, but the stability of the leaders of it. And he gave a very direct and honest, and I would say just a kind of a, it's something you could get anywhere. You could just turn on the television and come to the same conclusions that Darich was. And, he ended up like a casualty himself. I mean, it's really just scripted perfectly almost.
I must say that I went to one wonderful party at the British Embassy, and hosted by Ambassador Derek and his wife, Lady Derek. And there at that party, I remember hanging out with Sean Spicer, Sarah Huckabee Sanders, Hogan Gidley, Kellyanne Conway, go down the list. They were all there. So this was a guy that they took advantage of, too, while he was here.
Yep.
Donald Trump slamming him. Maybe a little too late. My favorite story of the week, I have to tell you, my very first car that I bought when I got to San Francisco to teach school was a VW Bug. And this week, the very last VW Bug rolled off the assembly line in Mexico, of all places, not in Germany, of course, in Mexico, is the last bug made. They announced this is it. They're not going to make any more. And this one was Stonewash Blue. So look for that rolling around here. But that's really, I don't know how far back when they started making them, but it was a great car. It was a lot of fun. At any rate, it is gone. Gone today is our roundtable. Thank you guys very, very, very much. I'm going to close with a little parting shot, which I want to hasten to add, reflect my comments only and not necessarily the comments of the members of our panel. I know that day after day we slam Donald Trump for getting something wrong. No, George Washington did not have an Air Force. No, all immigrants are not terrorists. And no, Trump is not the best president since Abraham Lincoln. But once in a while, even Donald Trump gets something right, like his comments about former House Speaker Paul Ryan. Ryan's now trying to rebuild his reputation by blasting Trump in the new book, American Carnage, by Tim Alberta. He didn't know anything about government, Ryan says, telling Alberta he couldn't stand being around Trump for another 2 years, and that's why he quit. To which I say, bullshit. Ryan quit because he knew he was a failure as speaker and couldn't get anything done. So let's not now rush to crown him as some new political profile in courage. After all, what did Ryan do about Donald Trump while he was there? Absolutely nothing. After a mild criticism, he stuck with him as presidential candidate, even after the Access Hollywood tape came out. He supported the Muslim ban, he supported the wall, he supported getting out of the Paris Climate Accords, and the Iran nuclear deal. Paul Ryan, in fact, was Donald Trump's biggest cheerleader in Congress. Why? Because all he wanted was another huge tax cut for the rich, which Donald Trump was more than happy to give him. So, no, Paul Ryan is no hero. He was the one guy who could have stood up to Donald Trump, but never did. He's a political coward, or in Donald Trump's words, he's a lame duck failure. Donald Trump may be wrong about everything else, but he's right about Paul Ryan. My parting shot for today, that's a wrap. Also for this week's roundtable, lively as always. If you like what you heard, and how could you not, please tell all your friends. And it's easy to find us on Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Spotify, Stitcher, or wherever else you go to find your favorite podcasts. And while you're there, please subscribe. It's free. And give us a 5-star review. That's the best way you can help us about the Bill Press Pod. So thanks again to our political panel, Eliza Collins, Jason Dick, and Richard Fowler. Thanks to all of you for listening. Stay strong, and we'll see you on the next edition of the Bill Press Pod.